Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our meeting today. If you're one of our guests, we're so glad to be able to be together, and we're glad for the presence of each one. I want to thank Elijah for choosing our songs and planning our service today. Good job to you, Elijah. And thanks to all of you who've been helping to do things in our congregational life over the last several days and who will be today and through this week. A lot of you served Miss Joe's family the other day. Joe, we are still thinking of you, and thank you for sharing Miss Ann with us. Our elders have been involved in a time together with each other to think about our work over this weekend. We appreciate the time invested in that. Thanks to Casey and Christina, several of our young people have been able to make the trip. They're still away this morning. They've been to YOU down in Conway, Arkansas. Thanks to some of your kinfolks for putting up our kids over this this weekend as well. A lot of different activities. We appreciate the involvement of each one. I was listening to a high school football game, an exciting high school football game. Two guys were calling the game or announcing the game and describing it as it went along, and they, of course, were very much on the side of one of the teams. The team they were representing was on defense, and about midfield out there, about midway, the other team ran a play, and in the course of that play, the ball got stripped from the ball carrier and hit the ground, and one of the defensive players, one of the players that these guys are calling the game for on the radio, picks up the ball and runs it all the way back and scores the big touchdown. And the excitement in these guys' voice took over at that point. One guy said, "There's the big turnover we've been waiting for." And the other guy spoke up and said, "A takeaway and the defensive score." And they called out the coach's name, and he said, "He's been begging for that all year." And finally, at just the right time, he got it. He's been begging for that. I was reading about the great works of Jesus, the mighty works of Jesus in Luke chapter 8. And it struck me how many times while the Lord is doing His work and while His power is on display, there are beggars who enter the picture. It's impressive how many times people come up to Jesus in the middle of His ministry and beg Him for certain things. Now, He welcomed people and He came to give people things, but it's interesting to ask whether what they begged for is what He was putting the emphasis on in His work. There are, in the course of this passage from Luke 8, verses 26 and following, there are actually four different words that are translated often in the English Standard Version to beg, but they're words that have the range of meaning all the way from on the less urgent side to ask or to request, to moving a little bit more urgent, to urge or to beseech or to implore, even the word supplication comes from one of them, and then all the way to the much more urgent, as high as you can get level, to beg or to plead or to fall down and just almost insist, you see. I want for us to watch people begging Jesus for a few minutes here and then to try to draw some conclusions for us from it. Time-wise, instead of just trying to read the whole passage, I'm going to have to tell us about it. I invite you to have your Bible open to Luke 8, and we'll start at verse 26 and move through it as quickly as we can. Watching people beg for Jesus. First off, Jesus gets out of the boat on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, which was a Gentile region. And almost immediately, there's a guy before him here who has been impressed by so many evils, has been oppressed by so many evil spirits or demons that their name is Legion. I'm pretty sure there's a whole lot more about the evil spirits and the possession of evil spirits or demons in the time of Jesus that I don't know than that I do know. But even I can make some observations about what goes on that I think might be useful for us. First off, presence of demon possessions or being oppressed by evil spirits is not a continuous thing through the Bible. It happens at moments of crisis when God is engaged especially in moving His purposes forward. Secondly, whenever evil spirits are present or in possession of someone, it's not simply a disease, because you can see in the guy that we meet here, he has power that's not explainable that way. Thirdly, the influence of these evil spirits is terribly destructive in the lives of the persons affected. This guy, for example, that we meet has for a long time had this problem. He's gone about without clothing. He has lived in the tombs. Whenever he has had opportunity, he has cut himself or engaged in self-destructive conduct. When they have tried to chain him or to bind him, he has just broken those ties asunder and then kind of gone wild out in the wilderness again. Next thing I notice about these evil spirits is that they know Jesus before anybody else does, and they're afraid of Him. Because He is on the attack, He comes to enter the strong man's house and to bind him so that people can be free of the evil influence and the suffering that He brings. And then I notice that the farther the gospel accounts go in the story, the less frequent the presence of these evil spirits who possess people are. And more often, Jesus meets evil entrenched in the behavior of people, like the religious leaders who are willing to work up a crowd or to hire lawyers or to determine to get him crucified. So here's this guy impacted by evil spirits in this way, and he falls down before Jesus, and he says, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" The first part of that statement is almost as if it's saying, "What business is this of yours if we're ruining this man's life?" And then you notice that they use the most frequent Gentile way of referring to God, the Most High God. But they recognize Jesus as the Son of God. Now, the demons beg Jesus for three things. Kind of put them together. We beg you, or I beg you, don't torment me. And then they begged him, I think verse 28. Then in verse 31, they beg him to not send them back to the abyss, the pit, the place which was reserved for the devil and his angels, the place where evil is kept under bondage until time for God to judge it, according to 2 Peter chapter 2. The abyss was worse than what was about to happen to him. The third thing is they begged Jesus to let them enter a herd of pigs who were being kept there in that Gentile area. All three of those are things maybe that you and I would not beg for. But evil, if you notice, evil wants to be unhindered, to be itself, without having to face the natural consequences of itself. And it won't work, because there's still the principle of reaping and sowing that's involved. Anyway, Jesus gives evil the permission. They entered into the herd of pigs, and the herd of pigs immediately rush down into the sea and drown and destroy themselves. You still see the self-destructive impact of evil that's present there. But they've gone out of the man. The man is left there. So that's the first begging that goes on is by evil. Secondly, the people who hear about that from the neighborhood, from the town and the country that are around, the herdsmen immediately run off and tell everybody what's happened out there that day. And of course, naturally, people have to come and see. So they got there, and the people who had seen it happen, others of them, tell them exactly how the man who had, the demon-possessed man had been freed from all of that. And the visual aid is present. The guy is sitting there, clothed and in his right mind at Jesus' feet. And you would think, man, all of his friends and neighbors in the area are going to be so glad to hear about this. They're going to all go up and put their arm around his shoulder and congratulate him for the improvement in his life. But no. They beg Jesus, they ask Jesus, they request that Jesus kindly leave their area because they were overwhelmed by fear. They had suffered maybe a financial loss, their world, their routine had been interrupted, but they beg Jesus to leave, which of course he does, but you think about it for a minute. There is a begging which wants to not have a program, a routine interrupted. There is a view of life that does not want to be in the presence of the kind of power that Jesus exercised in making that man well. There is a view of life which does not want that power to be something that you yourself are accountable to, you see. Jesus respects their begging, and he leaves. And then there's the guy that he's just set free from the demon possession. There he sits, and he's heard all of this go on between the crowd and Jesus. He begins to beg Jesus to go with him. His request is that, notice he doesn't know where Jesus is going or what he's going to do, but he does know that he wants to go with him and just be with him. Maybe to be a disciple who travels with him and gets to hear and see all the things that he does. Jesus tells this guy, no, you go back to your home and to your neighborhood and you tell your friends and neighbors all that the Lord has done for you. The one fellow who wanted simply for Jesus' will to be done in his life is told, no, I've got a job for you back where you came. If you think about it, the Lord might be saying, your friends and neighbors are afraid of me, and they've just asked me to leave town and get out of their country. But you, they know, you could stay here and you could tell them what I've done for you. You know, the idea of being able to tell someone what the Lord's done for you is still the most useful and helpful form of doing the Lord's work. Speaking positively about what he means to you and what he's done in your life. Someone gifted me a while back with a set of Brooks Blevins books, A History of the Ozarks. Blevins is a professor over at Missouri State University. Some of you may know an excellent writer, very good books. But he tells about the settling of our country here in the Ozarks. Some of the first settlers and their riding back home. And I found this in it. In the In the 1850s, a man named J.H. Scott moved to Greene County, Missouri from Kentucky. And he wrote his family and his friends back home in Kentucky. They were wanting him to get back over there. But he wrote them about Greene County. His words are maybe like my spelling and not proper, but I thought I'd read it to you. Southwest Missouri, the best country in North America, and the best country for a poor man to take a start in that I ever see. I want you all to move to this country this spring. I know I can do better here than any place I ever was in my life. What do you think he was wanting? He was wanting people he loved to be where he was, so he spoke well about where he was and what the Lord and his providence had done for him in a manner of speaking. Well, there is that kind of begging that just wants to be with Jesus, but which is willing to go and do what he says in the meantime and to be using his service. Next guy that Jesus goes back across the lake to the west side of the Sea of Galilee where Capernaum was. Boat pulled up and there's a crowd of people waiting on him. And a ruler of the synagogue, the fellow who was in charge of the meeting place on the Sabbath for the reading of the Lord's word and worship of the Lord and so forth, falls down in front of Jesus and starts begging him to come to his house. He doesn't say what to do. He doesn't give him instruction, just begging him to come to his house. The reason is his 12-year-old daughter, his only child, is sick to the point of death. You remember the story of Jairus' daughter. There's no discussion with Jesus about whether to go. He just went. And Jairus learns on the way the Lord's willing to go to his house and to help him. But he's going to have to do it where there are other people around, in a world where there are other people who are acknowledged and other people who are helped too. We'll mention in just a minute how. He's going to have to learn that he's going to have to let the Lord do his work and his time, and that's going to require him to deal with some discouraging things that people say. I mean, people come to him and say, "Don't bother the teacher anymore. Your daughter's dead." He's going to have to deal with the idea of people who ridicule his faith in the Lord when Jesus said, "Don't be afraid, she's not dead, she's just sleeping." They all laugh at him. But he's going to get his daughter back. The Lord's going to give her to him. There are people who have very urgent concerns, who beg for healing, for things to be well, for their loved ones, for their family, for their little ones, their children or grandchildren. It's encouraging to see Jesus paying the kind of attention to one man's 12-year-old daughter that he does in this situation. I don't know what happened to Jairus after this. That's interesting to think about. But you can see and you can identify with him maybe. There's also in the crowd along the way one person who begs Jesus without ever saying anything. She's a woman who's been suffering something for 12 years. She spent all her money trying to find somebody who can help her with it, and nobody has. It's something that would have caused her to be regarded as ceremonially unclean, unable to participate in community, unable to belong. She's heard of Jesus, and in her mind, she doesn't want to be the center of attention. She doesn't want to have to say anything. But if she can just come up behind and touch the hem of his garment, that's begging. And this is a man who responds to that kind of request. Well, she does, if you remember. And immediately she's made well, but Jesus does her the favor of showing in front of everybody that she's made completely well. And that she is welcomed. He addresses her as daughter, the only time in the Gospels where this tender term is used to address a person. He includes her then and the family in that way. There are people who beg simply to be recognized, to be made whole, both in body and spirit, and to be included in fellowship. Now, there are at least five ways that begging takes place here. The evil spirits, the man of the crowd that comes out from the country to see the fellow, the man who's been made well, Jairus, and this woman. Now, think about that for a minute. These are pictures, first, of what Jesus does want to do in the world for all of us. He wants evil to be cast out. He wants to be welcome and at home in our lives. He wants to include us or to use us in His service according to what He knows would be best and the way that would be best for us. He wants our families to be free from pain and grief. He wants us to be well and whole and at peace and included in fellowship. But He can only do that if that's what we're asking for. Last week we did the study, God calls us into His own kingdom and glory. Is that what we're asking for? Is that what we're calling on Him for? The second thing that stands out from this is the need for us in our lives, us Americans, us Westerners, to actually have things that we recognize that we would be willing to beg the Lord for. We are people who are comfortable enough and who have so few outward, urgent, apparent needs that there are not these kind of passions that really drive us to not care what anybody thinks, but to ask the Lord, to plead with the Lord, to beg the Lord for answers to them. Miss Ann has talked to me a good bit. I've heard you talk a good bit about the difference between America and Malawi when it comes to spiritual things. The hunger, the thirst that's there, and the apathy that's often here. Remember that Jesus said in the beginning of His ministry, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. The words for hunger and thirst mean to be starving and to be perishing of thirst. That's how strong the desire needs to be. That kind of passion or desire needs to be rekindled in our lives where what the Lord wants to give us is concerned. The third thing that I can't help but notice is at the end of Luke chapter 8 goes with the beginning of Luke chapter 8 in a lot of ways, and especially with the parable of the sower. What we want from the Lord, what we beg Him for, maybe can be illustrated with the parable of the sower and its applications. Is it the hard, barren ground like the evil spirits who just wanted Jesus not to hold them responsible for their own actions? Is it the rocky ground where the word may be received with joy initially, but there's no real root there, like the people who were sort of interested in what had happened, what Jesus had done, but wanted Him out of the way pretty quickly? Is it the thorny ground where maybe guys like Jairus, yes, in this moment of dire need, call on Jesus. But then what happens as the cares and the riches and the pleasures, what does a ruler of the synagogue do after his daughter is made well and after Jesus is gone? You see that? Do they stay with it or not? And then there's the good ground where what we're asking for is what Jesus is offering. What we beg for is really what he wants to give us already. And where that causes us to accept the gospel, to let it grow deep in us, to continue in it, and to begin to let it bear fruit to God's glory and to our good. I don't know what you're begging for or if you're begging at all. I encourage us to explore the corners of our lives to see what we should be begging for, whether we're begging the right guy for them, and whether we're allowing him to give them to us as would be best for us. If you're a believer in Jesus, have you made the good confession? Have you been united with the Lord in baptism? And are you walking in newness of life with God's help? If we can help you make that beginning, we invite you to let us know by coming here to the front while we stand and sing together.